Hello, everybody. My name's Jim Goldstein, and I'm here with Paul Sauer. We are actually business professors at Canisius College in Buffalo, New York, so we were able to drive down today. This is our second SABRE. We presented on revenue determinants last year in New York City, and we're coming back today to actually expand upon some of the analysis we did back then. So I'm going to introduce the topic, talk a little bit about where we were last year, and explain the motivation for this year's study. I'm going to turn it over to Paul. He's the real statistical brains behind the operation, so he's going to be able to field all your technical questions. Let's get started. So last year when we were at SABRE, what we started looking at was how does on-field performance translate into financial success? And this has been looked at in the past. We mentioned this last year as well, but very well by Vince Gennaro and Nate Silver in their works, Diamond Dollars, and Nate Silver's book as well. And we started looking at that with that as a foundation. So just getting into this, we're using a slightly different methodology than Gennaro did and Silver did, in the effect that we're looking at revenue as an average number across wins. We understand the reasoning in those works that I just mentioned that not all wins generate revenue at the same rate. For example, as has been pointed out, if I'm a 500 team and I'm just getting above 500, that win is not going to generate revenue at the same rate as a win that will get me into the postseason. Okay, and if I'm already solidly in the postseason, that win over that amount that got me into the postseason also is not going to generate revenue at the same rate. However, given the objective that we have for our study, we're looking at this from the perspective of player valuation and branding implications. So a popular way to look at player value is by looking at the statistic WAR, wins above replacement. So as an example, in 2017, Mike Trout had a WAR of 6.7. Which means, as we all know in the room since we're here at this conference, that because Mike Trout played for the team that he did, that team was able to generate 6.7 more wins than if Mike Trout had not been playing there, but an average replacement player had been. So since we're looking at this from the financial standpoint of what is a player worth, that's kind of where we're going with this, we don't know exactly which 6.7 wins Trout contributed to the team. I'm sure if we did the analysis, we can get down to that nitty-gritty. We're looking at this from an overall perspective. From a branding perspective, we're saying, what is important for teams? Is it on-field performance? Is it something else? And as a team, it's probably not going to change its branding strategy with every win that it takes. We're looking at revenue over all wins that the team has won. Okay, so it's just a different approach. Our revenue numbers are coming from those numbers published in Financial World and the Forbes amounts that come out each year. These have been endorsed by different researchers as well as on SABRE, so we're going forward with that. We can talk more about that if people wish. We're looking at teams, just like we did last year, we're categorizing them in four separate markets based on population size. I'll show you what those look like in a minute, but we primarily used Al Street's classifications in Baseball Reference. And we're also looking at two time periods. What we're calling the pre-revenue sharing time period, which goes from 1990 to 95, whereas there was minimal revenue sharing, and there's actually kind of an error in this next one. I meant to say that 1996 was really the time frame where the first comprehensive revenue sharing program was introduced. So 96 through 15 is where that comprehensive revenue sharing is taking place, and 90 to 95 is prior to that. Okay, so not going to read this to you, but we classified our teams in these markets. As an example, the mega market only has four teams. The way this is looked at is in the small market, these are environments up to 3 million people. Media market goes from about 3 million to 5 million people. Large market jumps up to about 10. And then mega market is 10 million and above. Okay, so just classifications. We're interested in knowing, and we believe this is the case, how do teams look different? How do they generate revenue different from a financial perspective? Okay, so getting us to where we were last year. Here are our main findings in SABRE 47 in New York City. All four markets show a significant relationship between wins and revenue in the pre-revenue sharing time period. Okay, we weren't really surprised by that. That's also what Silver and Gennaro have seen as well. Mega market teams, this is not surprising also, earn more revenue per win than smaller market teams in both time periods. Not a big surprise. This is what was surprising. This is what came out of this analysis we thought was most interesting. All four markets show less dependence on wins to generate revenue in the revenue sharing time period as compared to the pre-revenue sharing time period. So the importance of wins has significantly fallen off with the when it comes to revenue generation. Now the question that's going to come into people's minds is, what about these guys? You know, this came up before. It's like, these guys are obviously outliers. I'm a New York Yankee fan, so I have to bring this up. We ran the analysis removing the Yankees, and we came up with the same conclusion. So that made me feel comfortable that we're on the right track. Okay, so kind of setting the stage here. Gennaro, by the way, found the same thing, that in the revenue sharing time period, wins are less important from a revenue generation standpoint. We could say maybe that's competitive balance. Maybe fans are more interested in other things, and that's why revenue is being generated. That's why we're here today, to understand that. I put this in here because I don't know how statistically minded everybody is in the room. I don't know if people remember their stats classes, but we're using ordinary least squares regression, very simple methodology where we're taking variables and looking at the relationship between those variables, hoping to find some explainability. The idea behind this regression is that I have an intercept. That is, if I have no activity, this is the revenue I'm going to come up with. If I have zero wins, here's the amount of money I'm going to make. That's represented by B sub zero here, and then how much does each win contribute to overall revenue? So it's kind of building a relationship. You have points plotted on a scatter plot, if you've seen that before, and I try to fit a line there. Is there a linear relationship I can come up with? And we're primarily relying on what's called R squared. R squared measures the amounts of explanation and variability in one of the variables. So what we have up on the screen here, you'll see we have 90 through 95 highlighted in gray for all four markets. And this is kind of what I'm talking about. In the mega market, wins explain 18% of the variability in revenue earned by mega market teams. However, that falls to 12.5% in the revenue sharing time period. Now, we can go through all these numbers, but the main idea is this. I like this graph because it kind of summarizes it. The blue is pre-revenue sharing time period. The orange, I think that's orange, is after that. So we can see this is the degree of explainability that wins have on revenue in both time periods. So there has been a huge drop-off in the importance of wins to generate revenue across these two time periods. So that raises the question that I'm going to throw it over to Paul for is, we're looking at which determinants of revenue are most important in the revenue sharing time period. What are people paying for? We found this kind of surprising. So what is it that's driving revenue? So we looked at some other variables. We looked at star power. Is it individual stars on a team that drive revenue? The way we measured this was the number of all-stars that appeared on a team year by year. This gives us somewhat of a popularity index as well. Total team payroll. Is it the amount of money I'm spending on my payroll? Kind of related to star power. Is it the improvement in my performance year over year? It could be a decline as well. Is it drought, the number of years it has been since I've actually entered the playoffs? And then lastly, we looked at, these are just some of the things that we could look at. We only looked at some of these. With stadium age, since I've my last major improvement or a total overhaul, brand new stadium. So I'm going to throw this over to Paul now, and he's going to talk about what we found when we looked at these different variables in our analysis. So I'm going to get out of your way here, Paul.
Okay, what you see here are five variables that we thought might explain changes in revenue, and these include the additional wins and fewer wins, star power and salary, and the improvement to the facility. And so what we've done is, because they're highly correlated in this case between one variable and another, and you can see that with the first one, additional wins and fewer wins are highly correlated, where the values, if they're perfectly correlated, would be 1. If they're not correlated, would be 0. So they're close to 1 there. You can see that 0.841. So we ran what's called a principal components analysis, a data reduction technique, so we can then end up, instead of with 5 variables, we'll end up with 3. And each of the three that you see at the top, the components, are weighted averages of the ones that are in that particular column. So number 1 is a combination of additional wins and fewer wins, defining a win dynamic, sort of a win acceleration variable. Star power and salary contribute to player investment and represent player quality. And then finally, facility improvements stands by itself. So when we reran the regression analysis that we saw before, this is actually taken from the pre-revenue sharing period with our newer data. The data now includes all teams instead of just the teams that were in existence throughout the entire period from 1990 to 2015. And you can again see that in the pre-revenue sharing period, the wins dominate in terms of explaining the variation in revenue. 38.6% of the variation in revenue by small teams is explained by wins, and very little is explained by those other three variables we just saw: change in wins, which I called win acceleration, player investment, and finally facility investment. And this just shows the same thing with a graph. Those in the back may not have seen those figures in the previous slide. You can see that the blue represents the pre-revenue sharing period. The others represent the other variables that we put in there that we've added since that pre-revenue sharing period. Then once we reran this for the revenue sharing period, you can see the lower numbers down here. The ones at the top, up there at the top where you see the 38.6, 28.8, those are the ones from the previous slide. This is all our new data with pre-revenue sharing. Again, wins are dominating. If you look down here at the lower set here where it says revenue sharing 1996 to 2015, you'll notice that instead of wins dominating the explanation, you've got player investment. Change in wins, the wind acceleration or wind dynamic, didn't explain nearly as much, although it was significant. Facility investment, the smaller the stadium, the more it explained the variation in revenue. But player investment, player quality, is the one that dominates across all four size markets. And you can see again how much wins has deteriorated in terms of the explaining of variation in revenue there. And again, this represents the same thing. The green is the player investment, and the dark red there on the left is the wins that we've used in the past without the other additional variables. And now I'll turn it back to Jim, and he'll finalize this.
So what's interesting about this is, because we're in a new era, it almost looks like the presence of star players is more important today for teams to generate revenue than it is to actually win games, which is kind of interesting to us. This is how this is stacking up. And it kind of harkens back to, I remember this one kid when I was growing up in my neighborhood. His favorite team was the Atlanta Braves, and they were horrible. And I'm like, why do you like the Atlanta Braves? Well, first of all, because we didn't have any channels back then, and you got the Turner Network, and the Braves were on every day. But it was because of Dale Murphy. That's the only reason he liked the Braves, was Dale Murphy. Now, this was like in the pre-revenue sharing time period. But I'm wondering, are we at the point now where it's who's on the field as opposed to what the win-loss record is as to how a team's generating revenue? Very interesting. Big change from the past. The other thing that I think is interesting, too, is we looked at the numbers. It looks like the smaller the market, the more important the facility. We saw a negative relationship between the age of the facility and how much money a team was generating. So maybe the advice to smaller market teams is to keep up those smaller facilities. This data was kind of hard to come by because what I had to do is actually just kind of do research on all the stadiums and see when the last major improvement was. Not just putting a scoreboard up, but like, did they overhaul the concession stands? Did they put more seats in? Did they, you know, that's how we measure that. So it might be a little imprecise, but it did come out significant, so that was interesting. And then lastly, wins are less important today for revenue generation, but mega market teams, those teams in markets of more than 10 million people, they still are more dependent on past and current wins than the other markets. There's almost a total uncoupling for the other markets, but when you're a large mega market team like the New York Yankees, it looks like it really does matter how many games you're going to win. And I'm wondering, you know, being a Yankee fan myself, maybe because our expectations are so high that we really punish the team if they don't make the playoffs, if they don't perform or get as many wins as we thought they should. So those are pretty interesting. We thought we're still at the point where we're expanding this analysis. We want to add more variables and refine it. And figure out where we're going with it, but we just don't see as many studies out there in the academic world that really deal with revenue and how teams make money. So we find this very interesting. I don't know where we are with time, but that kind of takes us to...
You've got a good 10 minutes left.
Really? That was only 10 minutes long? Wow. Okay. Do you have any jokes? Should we do the Who's On First routine or anything like that? We can open it up to questions now, actually, if we want to. We're fine with that.
This is terrific, by the way.
Oh, thanks.
There should be, in theory, of course, a strong correlation between salary wins But what we're seeing here, it seems to me, and I'm wondering if you look into the internal correlation, what it seems to me is that with a lot of bad contracts being given up, and the whole analytics revolution is about spending your money more, you know, more wisely, and it's a work in progress. Even the smart teams, the Red Sox, have just jousted two unbelievably bad contracts in Pablo Sandoval and Henry Ramirez. What your finding suggests is that it's the names that draw the people to the ballpark, and if they'll keep on coming when those players of those contracts turn out to be bad. Whereas the teams that are doing it with unknown ball players, until those players become famous and start earning the salaries, they're not coming out to them. It's all fascinating.
What's interesting about that, too, is it's almost not something you can say out loud. You can't say, we don't care about wins anymore, but we're going to have these interesting players. You would never say that to the market, but maybe subconsciously the market is valuing the presence of those players than they had in the past.
The media.
I think one other thing is that you notice the media is when they've announced a game coming up, when it's not just baseball, it's football and other things, too. It's no longer the Pittsburgh Pirates against the Cincinnati Reds. It's whoever their star is, and the Pittsburgh Pirates against whoever their star is, and the Cincinnati Reds. So there's an emphasis on star power there.
Hi. So in your attempt to draw the line between less dependence on wins to the rise of revenue sharing, are you controlling for or otherwise factoring in the explosion of revenue in other areas such as merchandising, licensing, broadcast rights, and the like? I mean, does that have anything to do with anything?
Yeah, I mean, we got, like, your point is a good one, because we have, if we take just look at the mega market, on the left-hand side, we have the pre-revenue sharing time period, then we have the post-revenue sharing time period. And these, by the way, I should mention, these revenues are adjusted for inflation, so we did pull inflation out of this. But in all four markets, whoops, I'm going the wrong way, we're seeing an increase in revenue. And so what we did was we took total revenue across all sectors, merchandising, attendance, concessions, parking, whatever's being pulled in by the team, and linking that back to the variables. So we don't have a growth factor in there yet, if that's what you're getting at.
I just want to say,
how are you so sure that it's because of the revenue sharing and not because of the explosion of revenue in those other areas?
I think that's a good question, in the sense that it gives us new direction, in the sense that we should need to break down revenue into components and analyze each individually and then add them together to see what the effect is.
The tricky part of that, of course, is sometimes the numbers that are available out there don't always provide us enough granularity to get to that point. But since we're looking at explainability and focusing on R-squared, it almost neutralizes for the different sectors. It just looks at revenue as a whole. Revenue, like, you know, what's driving this revenue, and kind of breaks it into two buckets. So it's a good point. It's just like sometimes they just don't offer us much detail.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. But it's a good point.
Did any of this, did you guys take a look at either lag wins or some kind of auto correlation test score? It's comparable to the win improvement or the drought, but in some cases the expectations for the following season are driven, season ticket sales are driven by prior season.
So kind of like a hangover effect from the previous season, right? Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. So like when we ran our analysis, we actually saw a negative effect of what we're calling the improvement of wins over last year. It's almost like if I win fewer games this year than I did last year, it's almost like I'm making less money. So we kind of attribute that back possibly to the fact that I'm remembering back to the previous season, and I'm thinking about how the team performed then. If they performed better last season, there's almost a positive effect on revenue this season. One thing that we didn't mention, we said we were going to try drought. We looked at the number of years since the last playoff appearance. Paul's an Indians fan, so I feel bad about this. But they were the ones that actually had the worst drought number, but that's been taken care of. But we actually found that it didn't impact the analysis, so we pulled it out, which was kind of surprising.
But in terms of a lag regression analysis, we have not done that. And we did, so we didn't compute a kind of autocorrelation coefficient.
I am Tom Speech. I grew up in Cleveland. I'm an exile in Athens, Maryland, until the Indians won the World Series. Question I have on the Indians, they reduced the size of the ballpark from 43,005 to what's funny is you look at the box scores for the capacity of the ballpark the last couple of years, it keeps changing.
Sure.
After the they came out on the seats in the upper deck and right field, which we tend to see anyway. The capacity now is only 34,000. And my brother is really irate about this. We can't figure out how can they can make more money by reducing the number of seats in the ballpark.
Sure, and the Yankees did the same thing. Like, old Yankee Stadium had higher seats than the current Yankee Stadium. One of the things we thought about doing was using attendance, but that obviously is problematic because of what you just mentioned. Possibly a better variable to throw in there would be like percent capacity. So, like, you know, take it neutralizes all the stadiums for the number of seats. That's one way of looking at it. Also, what's interesting is if you take a look at this chart from Forbes, the green, the purple, and the black are really the portions that have to do with attendance of games. It's like concessions, parking, and tickets. It seems as if the part of the pie that is attributable to people actually attending baseball games is shrinking as online streaming, et cetera, and teams are less constrained by geography these days. But maybe we should throw in there like a capacity percentage to capture the effect that you're talking about, as opposed to a straight up headcount.
There's also more luxury boxes. And if you want to promote something in a positive way, you can look at the elections this way. It's always better to see a candidate go into a city where there's a lot of people pro that candidate, and so they'll engineer that through marketing research. And the other thing in the case of the Indians, it's better to see a stadium filled with people when you watch it on a TV broadcast. You're more likely to get the attendance to go up. It creates a positive atmosphere.
Sure. We were thinking about different ways of doing that, and we found a data source which actually had the number of all the all-star players on each team over our time period. So we did a simple count. So if somebody had six players on an all-star team, they got a score of six. If somebody had one, they got a score of one. And what I like about that is it doesn't just measure playing capability, it also measures popularity by the way that we actually vote for the all-star players. What was interesting?
Everybody had one, and six was the highest you found.
I think six was the highest. I can't recall exactly, though.
Thank you.
Sure.
I think I have a couple of questions. One is actually following up from one brought up by this gentleman. I want to understand this correctly. Is your simple single order relationship wins and revenue in the same year?
Yes.
Okay. So there is a bunch of research that was done in the economics literature in the 70s and 80s, mostly driven by attendance numbers when they were cleaner attendance numbers, which basically showed that the strongest and best relationship is how you did last year and what you make this year. So that would be my first recommendation. You need to pursue that path.
Sure.
The second point is, and I'm not sure how do you handle this, but in many of these cases, in a significant minority of these cases, teams are sharing, to some extent, the same market area. So teams which don't share their market area, Minnesota is a good example, and teams which do share market areas, and unfortunately, Baltimore, Washington is a great example, have very different dynamics. If you just look at simple numbers, for example, in a relatively new park, I checked this while you were talking, in the mid-1990s, the Baltimore Orioles drew 3.7 million people. They're never drawing 3.7 million people again, no matter what happens. In 2014, with a great team that had everybody fired up, they drew 2.6 million people. So there's real dynamics to this in terms of the market sizes and what populations are being shared. And it's also layered down inside of that, the reality that when the Baltimore Orioles had that big market, they owned a fairly wealthy Washington, D.C. population. They no longer own that population.
Sure.
The Nationals own that population. And Baltimore mostly draws upon a much lower income population.
Sure.
So that really makes us into this. And in front of me, again, I think this gentleman brought up or someone else brought up is, and you have the thing that shows this. The number I recall is that in the 60s, in comparisons of baseball, football, basketball, and hockey, baseball's revenue stream was 75% dictated by tickets, which none of the other three were even close to. Today, baseball's revenue stream looks almost identical to the NFL, NBA, and NHL, which is that tickets constitute, I believe, somewhere in the realm of about 25 to 30%. So that's a very different dynamic. And in the baseball case, the explosion of internet marketing and the 30 teams sharing that money has really dynamically driven. Okay, that was way more than
you. No, that was good. Thank you. Yes. All right.